It's the Truepenny Show with your host, James Truepenny.
Hello, welcome to the Truepenny Show. My name is James Truepenny. This is my show, and today we are back with Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling in Japan. And to join me for this momentous occasion, Mr. Alex Watt. How are you, sir?
I'm good. It is a momentous occasion. All Japan in the mid-90s. I'm good. Hopefully, last time we did one of these, I don't know how the sound came out, because everything sort of broke when you tried to call me.
We've got it sorted now, though. We've got everything working in my office. It's all good. So,
it's all fun. But so, yeah, I haven't been on since, like, G1 time. So it's been a while.
Yeah, so nice to have you back, really.
Thank you. Do you know, I only watched the G1 final today.
Good
because
Lord.
I've been so busy. Yeah, I know. Finally got round to it today.
You haven't got round to destruction in Hiroshima, which was yesterday then.
Yeah, so basically I had to watch that to make sure I was up to date so I can now watch the latest shows, and then I guess we'll be podcasting about that
next
in
week.
The next couple of weeks, yeah.
In fact, next week, because it was yesterday, so the next show is on next week, so we have to review that next Saturday.
There's just too much going on. There's too much wrestling, that's part of the problem.
Okay, well, today we're looking back in time to 1995 and looking at All Japan. Now, we couldn't find any specific shows to look at of All Japan wrestling in the mid-1995 specifically. So what we did was we picked some random shows from the year, because on YouTube there's a channel called Roy Lucier, and if you look at his channel, he's got pretty much most episodes of All Japan television. Most of them in general. He's got some All Japan Women stuff on there. There's loads of really cool stuff on his channel. But you can find lots of his matches. Lots of the matches and the TV show layout. And the reason why we picked the TV show is because we don't tend to look at TV shows in this era. We tend to look at the big shows. So we picked TV to see how they presented it and what was different about it. We wanted to see what the formula for success All Japan had in this particular time period, because they were making a lot of money. And we wanted to see really what King's Road was all about, because this was really the growth time for King's Road. This was the big time for King's Road. This was where the four pillars of heaven had really marked their card. Okay, so this was the time that they were growing as a group. Having watched these matches, Alex, what are your thoughts on the company and where it stands? It's a while since we looked at All Japan. In fact, we last looked at All Japan in 1990 with their World Tag League, when me and t'other Alex Edwards, looked at that. What are your thoughts on the company in this particular time space?
Right, okay, so basically we're in the golden era, basically. So you covered it, I guess, just before they made the decision to go in the direction that they were reaping the rewards of come 1995, I suppose, because this was, I guess, up until now, I suppose, the last couple of years with what's going on in New Japan, probably the greatest period of pro wrestling, particularly over there, because All Japan was firing on all cylinders. All Japan Women was firing on all cylinders. New Japan was doing good stuff with sort of their younger guys that they pushed to the top. In terms of the King's Road style, which was, I guess, in terms of match quality and drama and storytelling, basically raised the bar to another level come this time. Crazy finishes too, and dropping each other on your heads repeatedly and stuff like that. I think it was, by this point, they were sort of reaping the rewards of that long-term narrative storytelling. So what we see now in New Japan, which we love, has obviously taken a lot of cues from this era, which was kind of one of the main reasons for its success, along with the fact that they had all these amazing matches. Everyone had a clearly defined narrative. Everyone had clearly defined goals. You mentioned the four pillars of All Japan, obviously Misawa being the main guy. Then you had Akira Tao, Toshiaki Kawada, and Kenta Kobashi, who might be my favorite wrestler ever. So obviously I'm always keen to chat about him. But they all had clearly defined things. You know, Misawa, very much the hero, top guy. Akira Tao was, I think, 6'6", big. You know, he was the big guy. You had the bruiser in Kawada. Kobashi was sort of the perennial underdog at the time. But yeah, I guess it came from, I think, 1990 was when they decided they needed to look to the future, Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta. And they sort of handpicked Misawa as his successor, and they were going to focus on these four guys as their loyal, homegrown talent who would be the cornerstones of the promotion going forward. Which, yeah, there's the long-term Japanese planning and booking that we love. They were thinking years and years in advance. And yeah, this was kind of the culmination of that, I guess.
I guess really we should also explain what King's Road is before we go any further, because it's a while since we talked about this. So King's Road, essentially, there was the Inoki way. We talk a lot about Inokiism at the moment, and we should probably define Inokiism. Inokiism is essentially strong style, trying to present professional wrestling as a martial art, as a fighting system that can enable you to win matches via submission or knockout. Which it is. You know, there are plenty of people, Zack Sabre Jr., Minoru Suzuki, who base their professional wrestling style on the genuine shoot aspects of professional wrestling. Giant Baba did not want to do that. What he wanted to do was present traditional professional wrestling in the manner that Ricky Dozen had presented, but with a more modern twist. And he understood specifically that to make it more impactful, they had to have bigger impacts. So the attack moves came around the necks and the backs of wrestlers, which undoubtedly, as Chris Charlton said in his book Eggshells, which you can buy online now, undoubtedly shortened careers and undoubtedly shortened lives. However, it was a very impactful style. It was a very in-your-face style. And Baba wasn't against spending money. If he liked you and he thought you could do some good for the company, he would pay you good money to sacrifice your body for his cause. And his cause was King's Road. And the idea of the king behind King's Road was it was a very logical booking style. The idea is that you have to string together a certain amount of maneuvers depending on how good you are or how established you are in the company. So, for instance, Kobashi isn't as experienced as Misawa. So for Kobashi to beat Misawa, he has to link more moves together. So it worked a bit like a video game. It's like video game wrestling, really. And that was the booking style. But it was very logical, and it became very very popular artistically, but also very popular financially. You know, and also, the other thing that it was really important, clean finishes all the time. No countouts, no disqualifications. That was a nod towards the shoot style, where there was no nothing but definitive victories and losses. It was always countouts and submissions in shoot style matches. So Baba did pick that out from the shoot style idea. But there was always a definitive winner. There was always going to be an end to the story. There was always going to be an end game. And it meant that people had to come up with new stuff all the time, because if your finisher didn't work, then you had to develop a new finisher, which is where we get moves like the Burning Hammer from Kenta Kobashi.
Yeah.
You know, the most ridiculous finishes that anyone has ever imagined came forward in All Japan because they had to hit hard. So having said that, then, our first show that we looked at was from April of 1995, which had a couple of matches from the Championship Carnival. Stan Hansen versus Johnny Ace, better known these days as John Laurinaitis, former talent manager for the WWE and, of course, former brand manager of Raw on a Monday night. What did you think of Big Johnny versus Stan Hansen, Alex?
It's crazy because you forget how sort of good and high up the card Johnny Ace actually was because of all that stuff he did in WWE, which was
terrible,
cringe-inducing, yeah, a lot of the time. But yeah, I suppose it's worth mentioning as well with this era and the King's Road stuff that they had those four pillars, like we say, and I think Jun Akiyama was coming through at this point as well, so he was probably the fifth guy. But by this point in the mid-90s, they had those guys, and then they had this solid bunch of gaijins, the foreigners coming in, who they could use sort of in a rotating manner to throw in amongst those four top guys, and they would always be a threat to those heroes, sort of an obstacle for them to overcome, I suppose. So, I mean, with this one, the Stan Hansen stuff, I mean, he was basically, he kind of fit the stereotype of what Japanese people thought Americans were, which I think is why he was, besides the fact he was a very good worker, he also beat the crap out of people, which wasn't it because it was something like he can't see that well.
Yeah,
so
essentially.
I think a big part of his style was he just couldn't see what he was swinging at.
Stan Hansen was basically one step off legally blind.
And
as Michael Hayes described it one day, you're coming off those ropes and you look at Stan and he squints at you and you're going, oh, this is going to hurt. Because he's going to hit you. It just depends
right
where.
Place, yeah.
Yeah. It was a kind of like he left no room for error. What I found interesting about this match was it was a tournament match. So he wasn't after like the big move win. He was just trying to get out of there as quickly as possible, beat Johnny Say, Ace, go home. And it was a very different philosophy to like a big championship match, which we'll talk about later, that he had with Misawa, where it's all big hits all the time. This was a bit more controlled and a bit more, I'll take a submission, I'll take a count out win. I've got to get to this, got to get through this young whippersnapper who's going to snap at my heels all day. You know, it was a very interesting kind of approach, methodical approach from Stan Hansen.
Yeah, yeah. And I think exactly that with the finish was, I believe Johnny Ace misses the moonsault and then Stan Hansen just decapitates him with the lariat, basically. Just pins him immediately. It was that idea of just, they built a lot of it around him trying to hit the lariat as well, which, you know, is, you see it all the time in tournament matches now. You've just got to hit the big move and try and get out of there as quickly as possible. But yeah, again, it kind of points to a golden era, I think, for, again, up until now, of kind of gaijins in Japan, because you had like Johnny Ace, you had Stan Hansen, but you had Steve Williams there at this point, Terry Gordy, Dan Spivey we'll chat about in a second.
Yeah.
I think Ted DiBiase had moved on by this point, but he was there obviously in the early 90s as well.
Yeah, I mean, Terry Gordy had left the year before because of his ill health issues.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and Steve Williams was probably the top Gaijin draw around about this time. This may be the time when he took some time off because he wanted to open a gym in Hawaii.
Him and Johnny Ace might have reigned as tag champs at some point in 95, so I think he was still around, yeah.
Johnny was the replacement for Terry Gordy, which shows you the respect that they had for him in All Japan Wrestling. And to be fair,
I think he had a hand in the booking at this point as well, Johnny Ace.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a bad wrestler. He was Motoko Baba's favorite wrestler, which always helped.
I think that caused some trouble later on, which will, when we come to the split in All Japan and stuff, I think, there's plenty to discuss there, but she definitely took a shine to him.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, apparently McMahon's daughter, I can't remember her name. Stephanie McMahon, there you go. Stephanie McMahon was a big fan of Johnny Ace as well, like on an executive level, which was much to the chagrin of one James E. Cornette.
Like so many things are.
Yes, but I mean, if you look at the, I'm looking at the championship calendar results from this year, from this period. So if you look in 1991, which was the return of the championship carnival, Jumbo Tsuruta wins it. In 92, it's Stan Hansen. In 93, it's Stan Hansen. In 94, it's Toshiaki Kawada. And in 95, it's Masahiro Misawa. And in 96, it's Akira Tayu. And in 97, it's Toshiaki Kawada. So, you know, those four pillars are getting their hands in early at this point. They're giving them plenty to do. You know,
apart from Paul Kobashi,
who was a step behind. But that was
just, this was just after the period where he was like losing every match.
Yeah, Kobashi was Baba's special project. You know, Kobashi stared at lights for about a year and a half. They were really making him suffer because they knew that he knew the fans would rally behind him because he's a brilliant pure babyface.
Yeah, it's safe to say that project paid off. But yeah, I mean, that just to go off on a tangent, that of like the long term thinking and storytelling, which again, it's obviously Jado and Gedo are influenced by this stuff with what they're doing in New Japan, where you're thinking 1, 2, 3 years down the line of, you know, Kobashi will lose for a year and a half, but when he finally gets those wins, and obviously the fact that Misawa started tagging with him and he was basically his apprentice sidekick, if you like, before they basically had the greatest rivalry ever, a lot of people would say, when they finally sort of split and started both wanting the top title. It's all, you know, this is years of planning going into this.
Yeah, and, you know, they've got Hansen to get everybody over. They've got Williams to get everybody over. They're the previous generation, and they were got over fairly quickly in 93. Well, you know, Steve Williams certainly was. We've gotten over very quickly in 93, and obviously Stan is Stan. Mm. You know, he's over. So, you know, those guys were the ones that got the homegrown talents over, as we'll see later in this card, or later in the show. And then it was just down to those guys, Kawada, Tayu, Misawa, and Kobashi, to really tell their stories. And, you know, they used this system, the King's Road system, to get themselves over. There's other issues that were going on at the time. I mean, like, there was a period in 93 where All Japan was not doing well financially. You know, this was where they were taking the risk. One of the things we haven't talked about really was when Genichiro Tenryu left the company, this allowed this to happen. You know, if Tenryu had still been there and hadn't taken his top guys with him, you know, and they were very lucky because Kawada was one of Tenryu's guys. He could have gone with him, you know.
Yeah, the fact that he stuck around is obviously why they pushed him so hard, because they knew he would stay loyal to the company at that point.
You know, so it's like Tenryu leaves to form Super World Sports, which eventually doesn't become Wrestling and Romance, but Wrestling and Romance grows out of Super World Sports. So he takes a large lump of the All Japan roster with him. There's the FMW defection with people like Tarzan Goto go. So if Tarzan Goto and Genichiro Tenryu stay put in All Japan Pro Wrestling, that changes the entire complexion of the company, and you wouldn't have this entire series of matches, because there's suddenly a big hole in the plans of All Japan Pro Wrestling. They've got more money coming in from Nippon TV, who bought into the company, but Nippon TV were pulling up the purse strings tight at this particular time, so they had to kind of like come up with something creatively, and their creative answer was bring up the drawbridge, hire the gaijins we need, and keep it to our own guys, and that worked wonders for them at this particular point.
Yeah, it's interesting you say about that sort of 1993 period, because it shows the faith in that he had in this idea and the four guys there to carry the company, because I'm sure there's many wrestling promotions we could name who would have got cold feet and just decided not to go that way. I mean, it should be said, same period New Japan was doing a similar thing with Chono Muta Hashimoto of pushing the younger guys, so it seemed like there was some kind of idea, the top level in Japanese wrestling, that they were going to start pushing the younger guys to the top.
Well, let's talk about one of those younger guys. Toshiaki Kawada and Dan Spivey was also on this show from April the 8th, 1995. What do you think of their matchup?
Yeah, I think it's a good introduction to Kawada for people who haven't seen that much of him. You see why he was in that role. He was the heavy kicker, you know, he was the hard striker of those four pillars, I suppose. I think it was from, I watched these yesterday, and yes, there were a lot of sort of dangerous moves in there, so particularly with the power bombs and stuff, because they bloody loved a dangerous power bomb in that era in All Japan, didn't they?
Ganzo power bombs, with, yeah.
Yes, exactly. They got more dangerous as the 90s went on, and just you got closer and closer to falling on top of your head. But yeah, it was... I haven't seen a whole lot of Dan Spivey, I have to admit. I don't know what sort of info you have on him, but he was a lot bigger than Kawada, and it was an interesting dynamic in that sense.
Dynamite Kid used to call him Eugene. because he was, it was his middle name, and he was huge, so he'd call him Huge.
that's some solid British humour.
Yeah. Straight out of Lancashire, that is. But yeah, Dan was, well, I mean, Dan was, his knees were shot by this point, and you could tell as well. I was amazed he could move as quickly as he could, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he wasn't moving.
I mean, he had
fluidly, shall we say.
All Japan was his big money run at this particular time. I mean, his previous job had been in World Championship Wrestling, where he'd been the Skyscrapers with Sid Vicious first and then Mark Calloway.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder what happened to that guy. prior to that, he was in the second run of the US Express, taking Barry Windham's place with Mike Rotunda in WWE, but it wasn't as successful as the first run, as the new US Express, as it probably never likely to be as successful because you're replacing Barry Windham, and now do you replace Barry Windham?
Because Barry no Windham was tag audience. Team where they took a classic idea and put new in front of it ever worked. No, I don't know why they kept doing it.
I mean, like the Andersons, they didn't come up with the new Andersons, they were just the Andersons.
Yeah. But it was like the new Rock and Roll Express at one point and the new Midnight Express. Yeah. Like just stop it.
Yeah, just stop. Just stop. But yeah, Dan was a solid worker for a big man. He was probably in the Skyscrapers to ensure that Sid Vicious didn't walk so far out of his depth. It was ridiculous. And actually, daft thing was, one of the matches when I first started going to WCW, one of the matches I watched over and over and over again was the Steiners and Norman the Lunatic versus Doom and Dan Spivey, because it was brilliant, and it just showed the example of how to make an American tag match work seriously well with proper serious bad guys and proper serious faces, you know. And Dan Spivey was, you know, he was one of those guys. He could work really well, work well within his size, knew what he was doing. He was also Waylon Mercy when he went back to the WWE after this All Japan run as well, when his knees were long gone. But yeah, he perfectly serviceable wrestler, very good in this kind of environment. The last time we talked about All Japan, me and Alex talked about him and Stan Hansen in the tag league final where they lost to Doc and Gordy. You know, that was a fantastic matchup. So yeah, he's a guy who kind of embodies that All Japan spirit, you know, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, earn a ton of money, but you're going to pay for it because it's going to be hard work in those 2 weeks on.
Oh, yeah, but like we say, with bringing the Gaijins in to be the obstacles to overcome, like the height difference and stuff, and Kawada was obviously going in as one of the favourites in the tournament, so putting him up against a massive guy who he has to try and chop down to size is kind of the perfect heel for him to be trying to overcome, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, he was... Yeah, you look at that mold, you're right. I mean, obviously there's Stan Hansen there, Steve Williams, who isn't necessarily that tall, but look how thick he is and look how Dr. Death. You know,
yeah, they were big, burly men.
They were big and they were burly. But yeah, they're that kind of guy. And even like the lesser, the more mid-cardy guys, guys like Ranger Ross, perfectly serviceable, good quality wrestler. You know, they were never going to tear trees up, but that wasn't their job. Furness and LaFon were one of the best tag teams in the world. Phil LaFon or Don Crawford and Doug Furness were absolutely outstanding. You know, they were some of the best wrestlers you could find anywhere. And, you know, there was a story in Dynamite Kid's book about Johnny Smith, who was Davey Boy and Dynamite's other cousin. Johnny was kind of like scared to ask for more money, and Dynamite kept encouraging, saying, because, you know, if he thinks you're good, Baba thinks you're good, he'll keep you.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, what Johnny's kind of theory was, yeah, but he might not bring me over so many times. And it's like, no, he probably would have kept you, you know. And certainly, Johnny was still like a serious mid-card threat in this particular period of time, you know, doing tag team stuff. So there was lots of stuff going on in this card and lots of stuff going on in these particular shows we're looking at. The other match was on this particular show on May the 26th from Nakajima Sports Arena, was Matsuhara Misawa versus Stan Hansen for the Triple Crown. It doesn't really get much better than this, does it?
Yeah.
I mean, yesterday was Hiroshima Destruction. Now imagine this, but instead of the challenger being a small, indestructible guy, imagine him being a big, indestructible guy. that's essentially what you have, you know. Like, Misawa goes in as the underdog and certainly has a more flashy style, but it's still that basic thing with fighting spirit, that principle that Ricky Dozan portrayed back in the 1950s, be tougher than your opponent and show it through strength of heart. And that's how Misawa gets over in this match, and he wins the match in some style, but with a wrestling hold, not with the power moves, funnily enough, for an All-Japan match. There was a bit more science to Misawa than the first guess would give you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that was interesting in terms of this era, because like we said, it was very much about stringing moves together and big, hard-hit moves. So it was really interesting that this match ended with essentially a simple roll-up with Misawa taking a lot of taking a big beating throughout, basically, and having to pull off an underdog win, but made perfect sense in the context of what they were doing. I mean, Misawa was the most beloved guy in Japan at this point, like, basically had been since he was unmasked, really, as Tiger Mask 2. And they, like we say, that was all part of the build to making him the top guy in Japan. And he was the main guy of the Four Pillars. And yeah, it was really interesting match, this one. They'd obviously worked quite a few times in the past, knew the dynamic, and you had stuff like Misawa working Stan Hansen's arm when I think in previous matches it was the other way around. So they were doing constant callbacks to their previous matches. You had... trying to remember what all the sort of moments that happened in it. In terms of, I guess, the reaction, that was the big thing that stood out, of how they built through. It was an extended sort of heat segment on Hansen beating down Misawa, and when Misawa started firing up and coming back, the reaction from the Japanese crowd, which, you know, people, particularly in this period, like to point out how quiet and respectful a crowd were. They were going nuts, particularly when Misawa's making his comeback and Hansen sort of stops it and hits him with, I think, like a backdrop driver, drops him straight on his head because King's Road. And Misawa kicks out and the place just goes nuts, like, it's deafening. Yeah, I think, like we say, that was the beauty of that King's Road style of building and building the drama, which you see in everywhere now. I think, like, pretty much every wrestling match you see does that, of that constant build and the closing, you know, the closing sequences in New Japan, in NXT, on the indies. Like, that's what they're, it's all sort of calling back to this era.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the storytelling style we see today very much is heavily influenced by this particular time period, you know, and still, like, that King's Road style is still what Noah is based on. It's what All Japan is based on. It's what, to an extent, Big Japan is based on. It's, to an extent, what FMW would be based on. You know, there's a long reach with this stuff, you know. The basic principles of BABA are, you know, there's been more people split off from All Japan than there has other companies. Wrestle One is essentially a King's Road company as well. People who are in New Japan today, say Sanada and Tomohiro Ishii, were essentially King's Road wrestlers because of the way people who trained them. You know, Riki Chosu trained Tomohiro Ishii, but he spent a lot of time in War. He was kind of mentored by Jinichiro Tenryu, who was a King's Road wrestler before King's Road really got going. You know, his attitude to storytelling is very kind of... Baba would have loved Tomohiro Ishii. He'd been his kind of wrestler. You know, he was...
Oh, yeah, big time.
He's not a submission guy. He's not a big kind of like kick guy. He's a big it guy. Yeah, he's like, hit him hard, hit him often. You know, he's that kind of guy. So, you know, that those kind of guys. Sanada is another one. He's just a more delicate way of going about it. And you watch a lot of Sanada, especially like Sanada's G1 matches and Sanada's championship matches in Impact Wrestling when he was X Division champion. They're layered in a very specific King's Road style way. you know, and you can see the lineage from these matches with those wrestlers, definitely.
Yeah, it's funny because you hear a lot of wrestlers say they've been influenced by Japanese strong style. That's what they all call it, but...
Yeah, but it's
which
not.
That's, yeah, in terms of, like, the striking, it is, and I get why they would say that, but at the same time, it's not. It's King's Road that's influencing a lot of, particularly, like, the American independent style now. And I guess really the British strong style as well, which is obviously fusing your old school British stuff, but with that kind of drama when they're particularly, you know, you look at the stuff Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate and all those guys are doing over in NXT. It's this kind of stuff of constantly building the drama, crazy moves down the stretch, hitting, you know, people say with like, Kenny Omega now, he just spams the V-trigger, and it's like, but they were doing that in 1995. that's what that style is like. You're trying to hit them with your big moves. That's the whole point.
Yeah, I mean, Barber wouldn't have liked the V-trigger just because his argument was, why use the same move twice? Because logically speaking, if it didn't work the first time, you should try something else. That's the way part
there
of
is that. Yeah, but I suppose it's rooted in the same logic, but yeah. With
and it's not like
when you talk about
same...
like video game style idea, that's yeah. obviously a big influence as well.
Yeah, I mean it's not the same as like, you know, as far as Kenny's concerned, it's much the same with the Carter with the drop kick. That's his bread and butter, that's his jab. You take that away, you've taken away the majority of his offense. And the same with Okada and the drop kick to an extent, and Tanahashi and Dragon Screw Leg Whips, they use them over and over again because there is a principle to what they're trying to do there, and it makes sense. Like, you know. Okay, the last one we watched was from the 19th of September 2017, which is a two-matcher, which was The Patriot and the Eagle versus Stan Hansen and the late Bob Duncombe Jr., which was different because it was for Americans.
Yeah.
What did you think of this?
Yeah, the bloody Patriot showing up. I wasn't expecting that. I'd sort of forgotten he was in All Japan in this sort of era, and they obviously had the Eagle, which I think they'd kind of created just as a tag team partner for him, basically.
Yeah, it's Jack and Fulton from the Fantastics.
Yeah.
Who was a fantastic wrestler.
Oh, yeah. Perfectly named.
I've got some stories about the Fantastics. The Fantastics were awesome, by the way. More people should watch the Fantastics. The Fantastics were one of those teams that came along. They were kind of like the Mid-South team that replaced the Rock and Roll Express. So they came along in the Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express era. And therefore, and the Fantastics as well, like the original Fantastics and stuff. So they were never like... that over, as they were over in certain spaces, but they just didn't get over because all these other great tag teams were around at the same time doing very similar things.
Which there's a lot of stories of that. You're just sort of in the wrong the wrong time when there's all
wrong
these
time wrong other... place. Yeah, they were absolutely awesome. They did like 20 tours of All Japan as a tag team, a junior heavyweight tag team, going after those All Asian Tag Team Championships, and they were outstanding. You know, they had a big feud in they may have been responsible for the Bushwhackers, believe it or not, in a roundabout
right,
way.
Okay.
Okay, because they had a big money feud in Mid-South, Bill Watts' Mid-South, with the sheep herders, as they were known back then, not the Bushwhackers. This is before the Bushwhackers days, or Luke and Butch, the sheep herders. And they built up to the big event at the Louisiana Superdome, which was a barbed wire cage match. And it went over like gangbusters, as you'd expect a barbed wire cage match would do. And then Bill was like, great, we'll do it round the loop. 37 nights of barbed wire cage matches in a row. And after about a week, Luke and Butch went, yeah, we're gone.
Yeah, we're not feeling this, to be honest.
Bill, we're off. And then not long after that, they signed with the WWE. And, and the rest was history. And they produced all their own skits.
The rest is history.
Yeah, they produced all their own skits in the WWE. They didn't have a producer or a writer. They just did it all themselves. Believe it or not.
You see, that's what kind of used to be like back in the day before it was all so scripted as it is now.
If you wanted artistic license to lick children on the head, that was fine. You could do that back then.
Yeah, I think it's important that that's gone away. But
I was like, this is the thing. It's like the Bushwhackers now couldn't exist.
Yeah.
It's like the most family-friendly tag team in wrestling history, but they actually couldn't exist in the current in the form that they were presented in the 1980s.
Yeah.
But, you know, well worth a Hall of Fame spot, in my opinion. Anyway, let's get back to the show.
Wait, that was an interesting tangent.
It was. By the way, Sheepherders, also All Japan regulars in the 1980s. Moving on.
It's true, yeah. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, but what were we saying? Patriot and the Eagle. Yeah.
Patriot and the Eagle. But yeah, Jackie Fulton versus Stan Hansen and Bobby Duncombe Jr. The late lamented Bobby Duncombe Jr. Just before his run in WCW.
Yeah, yes, I think this was like they did sort of versions of this tag match quite a bit in this era in All Japan. Obviously, with because from what I know, Bobby Duncombe Jr. wasn't working in a lot of singles matches. He was there to work in tags and stuff like that, and to be there with the other gaijins when he was needed.
Because he was green as grass.
Yes, exactly. So you put him with Stan Hansen, the experienced guy, basically. But yeah, this is pretty much what you'd expect. They sort of clobbered the crap out of each other, didn't they? The surprising part was the result, to be honest. I just kind of assumed that Stan Hansen's team would automatically win, so it was a surprise that the Patriot picked up the win.
He was on a big push at this particular time. They were trying to gun him towards the Triple Crown Championship, and this was just before WWE came a Corwin.
It made sense the way they did it as well, it has to be said.
Also, funnily enough, when the Patriot did sign with WWE, his promo videos to bring him into the company were all Japan matches. Barbara released the videotapes for them. Which is bizarre.
Wow, that's very interesting. Yeah,
but I think they were trying to work on a talent swap agreement by that point, because obviously things were going a bit. They were trying to get some variation, and that was part of the deal, I think.
When WCW and New Japan had a deal?
Yeah, and also SWS had disappeared, and War wasn't running as many regular shows, and All Japan kind of saw an opening. And I think that, yeah, there's some stuff in Chris Charlton's new book about it. So you should buy that book. It's called Eggshells. It's really, really good. I've read it. I've got a press release copy for review. And I'm reviewing it in this month's Total Wrestling Magazine if you'd like to read that. But yeah.
Oh, very nice. Well, I will need to read that book.
Yeah.
For sure.
There's lots of background information about like the small stuff. We tend to go for like the aesthetic stuff, the stuff we like from a what made this show good for us kind of point of view, but Chris kind of deals with it more as a business kind of deal as well as the aesthetic stuff, so lots of the politics behind what happened on each show. And obviously you, in a book you can describe how great the matches were, but you know, we can tend to talk differently about it, though we're coming from a similar kind of point of view. But I recommend Chris Charlton generally. It was interesting and different to see an all-gaijin team. And the pace seemed a bit slower. They weren't hitting each other as hard.
They were still hitting each other pretty hard. Yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean. When you compare it to what happened in the match we're going to talk about in a second, where they were really hitting each other hard.
We should probably talk about that then. So the next match was regular tag team partners, Toshiaki Kawada and Akira Tayu. They ran a tag team. I can't remember like the Devil's Breed or something like that. They were like,
oh, hang on, I've got it written down somewhere.
Okay.
Holy Demon Army.
There you go, Holy Demon Army with Masafuchi.
Yeah, which is so Japanese again. Like, such a Japanese tag team name.
They were tagging with Masafuchi in a six-man match against Masahiro Misawa, Kenta Kobashi, and Taman Honda. Now, Masafuchi went back from the early 80s. He was one of the founding members of the All Japan roster. One of the first dojo class members, started off as a junior heavyweight, and he'd been around forever. He was one of those guys, you know, job for life kind of dude. And Honda was pretty much the younger version of what Fushi was. And this was a stiff match, but it was high stakes. These four were the best there was in the company, and they were out to prove that every night against whoever they were wrestling, especially when they were wrestling each other. What did you think of this?
Yeah, it was, I mean, for starters, if this is probably a good place to start if you want an introduction to the four pillars, I suppose, because they all get some good moments in there. I think you get a good sense of all four guys. This was like the year when they were banging out classics left, right and center in sort of various combinations between the four. I think this was shortly after Mazzara and Tarr had had a triple crown match. I think this was like the week after Mazzara had beat Tarr.
Yeah.
In like another classic, they had like a insane match earlier in the year. The tag match between the four of them's like held up as the greatest tag team match ever, still to this day. That happened sort of midway through 1995. So it was pretty, basically, whenever you put these four together in any combination, it was pretty damn good, basically. So they were sort of, the story they were telling this one, you had like Mizawa's knee was hurt coming off the title match, so they were all going after that. You had Kobashi obviously firing up and going after everyone as he did. And then you had sort of Homma's the younger guy wanting to prove himself. Obviously he was the guy they were targeting to take the heat and keep him out of the match, and they basically kept knocking Mazzara off the apron because they didn't want him to get in the match. All very logical. I think a lot of people will have seen a lot of Mazzara and Kobashi, but maybe not as much of Tao and Kawada. So
yeah,
a match like this where they're on offense a lot in a tag match is really, really interesting because you can see a lot of what they were about.
Akira Tao is actually in hospital at the minute battling cancer, so it's a good opportunity to do this particular podcast at the moment because we should highlight his work, and his work is excellent. I don't think he even gets as much respect as Kawada does, you know.
I was going to say exactly that. Because it's interesting when you talk about Mizawa's Triple Crown title reign, the matches against Akira Tao, almost, they don't get mentioned as much, even though they're insanely good. Yeah. Had two this year that were all-time classic status, but I think people with Mizawa think of his matches with the other guys a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, that series that Mizawa and Kawada had not long after this was breathtaking, is arguably the classic All Japan series. And then you build to the matches with Kobashi. But I think Tayu, and you know, Tayu's wrestling IQ is incredibly high. You know, when we're not going to get to the Noah moments, but when they do found Noah, the president of Noah is Tayu. It's not Misawa.
Mm.
You know, yeah. Misawa is the brains behind the operation, but the actual day-to-day running of the business, he entrusts Tayu to do that, not himself. You know, so, you know, he's a guy who's got the right brain. He's still young at this particular point. He's not particularly old. And you know, he was great. He was really, really good, you know. And again, none of this would have happened if Tenryu and Taz and Goto had stuck around. So, you know, they grabbed their opportunities because they saw how slight those opportunities were.
I think the fun of like a guy like Tay was because he was the big guy. So going up against Mizawa, for instance, it's allowed Mizawa to be the valiant babyface. Same with Kobashi, which, like we say, Kobashi's a great babyface. Mizawa's a great babyface as well, in, you know, in different ways, both of them. But they were both great at being the underdog babyface, fighting back, as much as they were as good as sort of beating the crap out of one another as well. But they were very good at fighting up against bigger guys. And he was, you know, Tayo was an amazing foil for Mizawa in that sense. And he was in this match with, you know, the match ended basically with him choke slamming Honma off the apron, which was brutal. Honda as well doing diving headbutts, which was interesting. But yeah, it was a brutal finish, basically, that kind of, you know, they were healing it up a lot in this match, basically.
What were your thoughts on the actual presentation of the TV show? Because it's a bit different to anything else. It's actually much closer to World of Sport presentation than anything I've seen.
Definitely with the music, which sounded like sort of British wartime propaganda music. It was very, yeah. There was definitely a British feel behind that music. But yeah, it was very just straight to the point, wasn't it? Of here are the matches, enjoy the matches.
Little bit of promo time, match. Little bit of promo time, match. End of show, 25 minutes flies by.
Yeah, exactly. It was, which is interesting as well for that era, because your main events were obviously going long a lot of the time, you know. So the fact that they were able to package it in a 25 minute TV show is interesting. Obviously there were cuts here and there, and I think they'd often come into the matches sort of while they're in progress and stuff like that, but it's interesting that they were able to make it accessible in that way, in a way that was almost like ahead of its time, probably trying to like present your 40 minute main events in a 25 minute TV show and get those storylines over, which was kind of the beauty of All Japan in that period. And you kind of comes back to what I touched on earlier, and you saw it in the six-man match. You know everyone's motivation in that match, even though I ain't got a clue what they're saying on commentary because I don't speak Japanese, but I know every guy's motivation from the context of how they're working that match.
Yeah. And also, like, you think about it, like, the way Access TV presents New Japan now. Jim Ross, Josh Barnett, no studio time, links to matches, commentate on the matches. Much the same way. And bear in mind that they were giving away their biggest matches for free. Stan Hansen versus Misawa for free on TV a week after it happened in the arena. You know, that's a big deal. And look what happens in Monday Night Raw and Monday Nitro. They start giving away those marquee matches, which creates this massive boom in wrestling. And it's kind of echoing that, really, isn't it? Or precursing.
It's a good point. I mean, how much those shows took cues from Japan, I don't know. I don't think Vince McMahon pays attention to anything that goes on outside his own company. I don't think he ever has, but
yeah,
there was definitely, I mean, in terms of the guys going into WWE and WCW, it was obviously they've massively been influenced by this stuff, and a lot of them had worked in Japan at times as well.
Yeah, definitely. Right then, we're going to have to call it for today, but thank you very much for listening to the Troopenny Show, and I'd like to thank my guest, Mr. Alex Watt.
Thank you. Yeah, we should do some more All Japan soon. I love watching this stuff.
Well, there was the 25th anniversary show in 1997, which we'll get to shortly.
Yeah, they were pretty good in 97 as well.
They were. 96. Yeah, the 25th anniversary show was in 96, I think.
96, 97, yeah. I think that Mitsuharu Mizar guy and that Kenta Kobashi guy went on to do some pretty good things.
We can find Alex at Alex... I'll try to get that again. You can find Alex, AlexWatt187 on Twitter, and you can find anything else you want to plug? The podcast, if you would like to.
Yes, my football podcast you can find at Did It Cross. Something me and my wife are doing. Very fun, very time consuming at the moment. But yeah, if you like Premier League, European football, we're chatting about that every week. Me a Liverpool fan, her a Chelsea fan, so it's usually a good laugh.
There you go. You can find me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter. You can find the show at Troopenny Show on Twitter, and you can find the show The Troopenny Show on Facebook. You can also find us on Patreon, where you can keep the show free forever for everyone. Thank you very much for listening today, and we'll see you next week, where we'll be looking at Destruction in Hiroshima, Tomohiro Ishii versus Kenny Omega for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. Take care, and we'll see you then. Bye.